Zero to Book is brought to you by Rainmaker FM, the digital marketing and sales podcast network. Find more great shows and education at rainmaker.fm.
A lot of people aspire to write a book. Maybe you do, but you probably know it's a complex process. Zero to Book is documenting the journey from start to finish so you can learn how to take your book from an idea to a published product. Listen in as best-selling author Jeff Goins helps Pamela Wilson go from zero to book.
So, Jeff, after our last conversation, I was ready to start talking about the name for this book, but you wanted to dial it back a little bit and talk about the big idea. So do you want to talk about that today?
I do. Because it would make for a really awkward show if I just said, no, I don't want to talk about
that. Okay, good.
What do you want to talk about? Well, I think before you name it, regardless of what you decide to name it, you have to have the idea first. And I think what you name a book comes from the big idea. And I even think that the title of a book can and sometimes does change throughout the writing, planning, and even editing process. But the big idea, once you've locked in on that, should be fairly static. Otherwise, you haven't really figured out what you want to say.
Right. That makes sense. And I have always said, you know, this is my working title because I've always imagined that as you put the content together, there's a possibility that a better name will sort of come to the surface, right?
Yep. Absolutely.
Okay. So the big idea, and when we were talking about this, we had this really interesting conversation that actually happened after I stopped recording last time. Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure we cover it because I think it's fantastic information for people who are putting together a book. And what you were saying to me is that there is a counterintuitive way to put together a book or to present your information that makes it more compelling. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Yeah. Well, I think there's just this fairly obvious trend. At least it's obvious once you know what to look for in business books, nonfiction advice and how-to books, particularly in sort of the business space, which would include online business, marketing. I would even, you know, include things like leadership. And you look at all these best-selling authors, people like Dan Pink, Malcolm Gladwell, who are writing these best-selling books that are what they call big idea books. And a big idea book tends to be one part narrative, one part academic research, and then one part how-to. That's kind of what makes up a big idea book. It's a combination of genres, and they tend to have this mass appeal where, you know, and Malcolm Gladwell talked about this one time about his books. He said, I want to talk about big academic ideas that the common public is not acquainted with. And my goal is to write about things that people discuss at dinner parties. And so, you know, when you're at a dinner party and somebody brings up a book that they read, something that they learned, they're talking about these kinds of books, a book like Drive or The Tipping Point or what have you. And what's you know, makes for a really compelling book is that they have these characteristics that all these books have. And when I set out to write my most recent book, I was like, okay, I've written a few books and they've done okay, but I want to write a best-selling book. And what I learned is that before you can launch a best-selling book, which everybody wants to do, everybody, you know, a week before their book comes out says, I want to hit the New York Times list. But what I learned is before you can do that, before you can launch a best-selling book, you have to write a best-selling book. In other words, it's much easier to market a marketable book than it is to, you know, market one that's hard to market. And what I discovered through this process of basically reverse engineering a bunch of recent nonfiction business best-selling books is they all had these characteristics in common. And at its essence, they were all counterintuitive books.
Okay, let's go over those characteristics just in case people didn't catch them the first time around. So what you're saying is they combine narrative, elements, right? Mm-hmm. Academic research, which I'm assuming helps to bolster the information that you're presenting. It gives it some weight and some authority, correct?
Credibility, yep.
Right. And then how to. So how to apply it and make it work in your own circumstances.
Right. Yeah. And the classic example of this is Malcolm Gladwell, because he is one of the most popular nonfiction authors alive today. And all of his books follow basically a formula, which is taking something that people assume is true and then twisting it and saying, well, that's not really true. Or you thought this wasn't true. And in fact, it is true. And that's what makes it counterintuitive. And so you can look it through, you know, all of Malcolm Gladwell's body of work from The Tipping Point through David and Goliath. And he takes an idea and he says, here's how we think things happen. So, for example, with The Tipping Point, here's how we think big ideas spread. We think it takes some sort of huge effort. And in reality, it takes something very, very small. And then he tells a bunch of stories that illustrate academic principles, you know, so basically the reader goes, well, you know, like a bunch of smart people with PhDs say this thing is true, therefore it must be true. And he does it in an accessible way and then provides opportunities for people to basically apply those lessons to their own experience. That's why you had marketing teams, you know, of which I was included years ago when The Tipping Point came out. I bought that book for everybody on my marketing team when I was a marketing director at a nonprofit. And I said, read this book. It's not a how-to book, but there are these ideas in there, and you're left wondering, how could we do this for our organization? And that's what a big idea book does, is it takes these ideas and packages them in stories and research to substantiate them, and then it puts it in the hands of lots of different readers that all leave them with something to do afterwards.
That makes perfect sense. So, and it's presented in this way where you're basically saying to the reader, you think you know it this way, but I'm going to show you a completely different way of looking at this topic.
Right. Yeah. And I read an article. So when I was doing this research about how to write a book, and I always feel embarrassed by this. I've written 4 books now, and every time I sit down to write a book, I feel like I'm relearning how to write a book from scratch. And I think that's kind of the way it goes. At least that's the way it's gone for me so far. I talked to Guy Kawasaki one time, who I think has written close to a dozen books now. And I asked him, is it that way for you? Do you have to keep relearning how to do it? And he's like, no. By book 7 or 8, you totally figure out how to do it. And I was on like book 3 at that time. And I was like, okay, so I'm only 5 away from knowing what I'm doing. Great.
You're getting there, but you're not quite there yet, right?
Yeah. So,
and that's how he's probably able to churn them out at the pace that he churns them out, right?
Yeah.
Because he's figured out this process and this approach that kind of works for him.
Yeah. So while I was doing that, I stumbled across an article by a guy named Adam Grant, who wrote a great book called Give and Take. And the title of that article, which I think he originally published on LinkedIn, was something along the lines of, I don't have it in front of me, but it was basically, here's why everything Malcolm Gladwell writes is so interesting. And what Grant does in that article is he finds this old research paper, this, you know, old piece of research, and he basically says that people think Malcolm Gladwell is popular because he tells good stories, and that's not true. He happens to be a good storyteller, but the reason that he's popular, because there's lots of great storytellers out there in lots of different genres that aren't nearly as popular as he is, the reason that he's so popular is because he shares interesting ideas, and he happens to do it through the vehicle of storytelling. And he references this paper from 1979 by a guy named Murray Davis called That's Interesting. And the subtitle is Towards a Phenomenology of Sociology and a Sociology of Phenomenology, which doesn't sound academic at all.
That is a mouthful.
And basically what the paper does is it identifies what makes what makes a thought leader so compelling. People like Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Jesus or you know, any number of activists or political leaders or religious leaders, what makes their messages so attractive? Murray Davis says what makes a leader a powerful and effective communicator is not that their ideas are necessarily good, it's that their ideas are interesting. And he defines that through what he calls the index of interesting, the index of interesting. And he identifies a dozen different phenomena that make for interesting content. And one example of that is what he calls the characterization of a single phenomenon. And one of the ways to present that is through organization. And so there are two ways to do this. One would be what seems to be disorganized is in reality organized, or what seems to be organized is in reality disorganized. So, you know, in The Tipping Point, which I referenced earlier, Malcolm Gladwell begins the book talking about how hush puppies went from basically near bankruptcy to becoming one of the biggest fads of, I don't know, the late 90s or whenever a bunch of hipsters started wearing hush puppies. And he says, look, this looks like it's just a random thing, but there's actually an organization to it. And he goes on to talk about how a bunch of little hipster communities in New York City started finding hush puppies in like secondhand stores, putting them on because it was ironic or whatever. And they started wearing them these parties, and these fashion designers and influencers saw it, and it took off. It tipped. And he lays out the data to, you know, prove why this happened the way that it happened, and that there was actually some sort of organization behind it. It wasn't just a random thing. That's this idea at work. And in this paper, I won't talk about all of them, Murray Davis lists 12 of those things. And they're very simple things, like what seems to be good is actually bad, and what seems to be bad is actually good. Malcolm Gladwell's other book, David and Goliath, is basically that. We think power is good, but actually power can be weakness sometimes, and vice versa. Weakness can be power. That's what's good is bad, and what's bad is good. Those kinds of ideas are just immediately captivating, as simple as they are, because people go, when they hear that, they go, what do they say? Oh, that's interesting.
Right. They create curiosity, I think, and create a desire to understand more and read.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this is the MO. It should be the MO of any nonfiction writer, especially in the business space, advice space. If you're writing memoir, you know, I think it could be a little bit different, although a lot of memoir these days is getting packaged as basically how-to books. You and I went to a workshop recently of Donald Miller, who's an author of these New York Times best-selling memoirs. And his most recent book is basically a memoir about how he got married. But if you read the back cover copy of that, read any of the marketing copy about that book, it's basically, it's positioned as a how-to book about how to have healthy relationships. And in reality, it's a memoir. So the book publishing industry, by and large, is moving towards more of this personal development, self-help, advice, and how-to. So in other words, if you're an author who doesn't write novels, then you need to know how this works, because this is what makes for best-selling books, and the lack thereof, because I've done it both ways, is what leads to irrelevance.
Right. I love this idea. And of course, my book is going to be about content marketing, so I'm listening to all this going, how do I do that with content marketing? But I think what I'll do is think about this a little bit. And then the next time you and I talk, I'll have some ideas for you to bounce off of you to see what you think about it. I suspect everyone listening is probably thinking about their topic right now and going, how can I approach it from a different angle that will create curiosity?
Yeah. Yeah. And what you have to do is you have to be honest about it. So if you force it, people go, yeah, I don't know. For example, if you say everybody thinks that content marketing is evil, but really it's good, and you're saying this to market that goes, no, I don't think that. Who thinks that? You set up sort of this straw man. You set up this false assertion that you then tear down, which isn't actually true. And I did this somewhat accidentally when I wrote The Art of Work, which was my most recent book, which was basically a book about how I became a writer. But it wasn't a book about writing. It was a book about finding your purpose. And I wrote the book, and it had these seven principles, things that I thought were true. So I kind of had the ideas in my head. Here's what I think this needs to look like. And it had these, an introduction and a conclusion in these seven chapters talking about these ideas based on my own research and based on my own experience. And it just felt flat to me. It didn't feel compelling. It didn't feel interesting. I knew it was true, But just because an idea is good doesn't mean that it's interesting. And I thought, how could I not change the truth of this, but somehow illustrate it in a more interesting way? And, you know, to give an example, one of the chapters was about practice. So if you want to be good at what you do, if you want to find your purpose, the first thing you need to do is practice a lot of different things and then find something that you can get good at. And that was, you know, that was a good idea. I mean, it's good to practice. It's not particularly interesting. So what I did, and so if you find yourself feeling stuck, one of the things that you can do if the answer isn't obvious to you is you can do not just quantitative research, but qualitative research, meaning you can go out and interview people, which is something that Brené Brown does really well. She's another example where she talks about things that affect a lot of people. She does it through narrative, fact-based research, of real people's lives. And then she brings this very honest, non-academic familiar voice to the content and, you know, through the vehicle of storytelling says, here's what I think is true. And it is accessible to a lot of people because she's following the same process, but she's doing all kinds of counterintuitive stuff, right? Like she's talking about being brave, and the best way that we can be brave is by being vulnerable.
Vulnerable, right. Yeah. It's the opposite of what you expect, for exactly. Sure. And it's funny, you started this topic by saying it's pretty obvious if you know what to look for. Right. But I have a feeling everyone listening is going to start seeing this around every corner now, because after you and I had the conversation, I started looking at all the nonfiction books on my shelf, the majority of the books on my shelf are nonfiction. So I have a lot to look at, and I'm looking at them going, that one, that one, that one, and that one, and that one too, and also that one. I mean, they're all kind of written this way. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is definitely what the market wants and rewards right now. And I would posit that almost any idea worth spreading can fit this paradigm. And the phrase to remember is this: I used to think this, but now I think this. And I was going through all the books on my shelf, as you were doing, once I understood this, and I go, how can I do this? And I came across a book by a guy named Bob Goff called Love Does, which is basically a memoir. It's a series of short stories about Bob's experience with faith. It's a spiritual book. So it doesn't just have to be, you know, business nonfiction books. And he begins every chapter saying, I used to think this about God or about life or about whatever, but now I think this. And then he tells a story. And what it does is Bob is just a crazy storyteller, and he tells all these amazing stories and, you know, about playing practical jokes and doing these, you know, incredible things out of love. He talks about how he became a lawyer. He wasn't let into law school. And so he just sits on the bench outside of the president of this law school that he wants to get into until the guy lets him in.
Oh, wow.
That's it, you know? And he used to say, so the beginning of the chapter says something like, you know, I used to think that when God closes a door, he opens a window, right? Like that's something that people say. He says, but now I realize that he wants you to kick down some doors. Mm. And it's a story about perseverance. So there are lots of different ways to do this. You can do what I did, which was I read a Brené Brown book and I go, oh, I should just interview a bunch of people and it will reveal itself, which is what happened for The Art of Work. I was like, well, I don't know what I'm missing. So I started interviewing people and I started to see the same thing over and over again. And what I realized was this: take the practice chapter, for example. I thought that you just had to like practice really hard and you would get good at it. But what I realized was there was failure involved in every person's story that I interviewed it. And I interviewed hundreds of people. So I was like, well, I feel like there's something here. There's a thread here. And it was aligning with the research that I'd already done, reading biographies, studying social science and psychology and all and skill acquisition, all these different things. Was I realized that it's not enough to practice. You have to practice the right thing. And you know, you have to understand how to get in that state of flow. Meaning you can't just pick any old thing and say, I'm going to be great at this, and this is going to be my calling or purpose. There's certain things that we're going to do better than other things, whether that's natural ability, wherever you think that comes from, that just dawned on me. And so the chapter about practice, you know, was really about your calling is not going to be easy. It's going to have to be something that you practice. But there are some things that are easier to practice than others, and you have to figure that out. And so, you know, you can, if you don't know, if the answer isn't clear, do more research. Or take your own personal experience like Bob did and say, okay, what's the thing that I've learned through this journey? You could do this, Pamela. You could go, look, I've been doing marketing. I've been run my own business for a long, long time. I used to think this about blank. Now I think this. And every chapter could, if every chapter followed one of those revelations, you would have a very compelling book for people to read, for them to digest, for them to talk about, as I talked about Bob's book. It's a very marketable book. And it's also an easy book if you're on a podcast interview or radio interview, or you're writing an op-ed piece or something for a magazine or a website. It's very easy for you to take one of those ideas and then repackage them and turn them into content elsewhere that markets the book. And so this is why I say that you have to write a best-selling book. You have to really bake the ideas into the book in the first place. And following Murray Davis's index of interesting, as he calls it, is a great way to do that. He calls this process basically taking an attack on what we tend to take for granted. So think about something that you take for granted, and then attack it and ask yourself, is this really true or is this always true? And then find a way to fill in the blanks. I used to think this, but now I think this.
Nice. And we do have a link with more information about that article and about those concepts. And I'll put that in the show notes about the Murray Davis concepts. You sent me a link on that, so I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, it's probably easier once you look through that and then you start looking at your bookshelf, as you said. And it just starts to come together. And after that, I do think it becomes more obvious. And then you also look at stuff that you've done, as I've done, and I look at previous books and I go, oh, that's why that was a good book, but it didn't catch because it didn't have that hook. And I think this goes way deeper than just putting a nice little subtitle or writing some marketing copy and trying to sell it. It really has to be baked into the book in a compelling, truthful way where people read it and they go, yeah, that is what I thought. And there's some sort of surprising realization. And now I feel enlightened and I want to go tell people about this.
Great. That's great stuff. Yeah. And it comes back to this idea that I've been thinking about, which is, I think when people are considering writing a book, they see the writing process and they maybe see the printing process and they don't really see how the ideas all pull it together. So what I'm thinking about a lot lately is a book is a physical object. It is hopefully a high quality physical object that you are able to get a beautiful cover for. So it is appealing and the inside pages have a beautiful design. So it's a beautiful, high quality physical object, but it's also a package of compelling information, which is what we've been talking about today. It delivers information in a way that's compelling, that creates curiosity, that makes people want to pick it up and buy it. And then, of course, and I know we'll be talking about this a lot in future conversations, a book is a marketing event.
Yeah.
And what I'm understanding, the more you and I talk, is that you really need all three of these for your book to work.
Yeah, I love that. It's a high quality physical object. It's a package of compelling information and it's a marketing event. I always go back to this quote that I heard from Seth Godin in an interview, probably with Brian Clark, if I think about it, where they were talking about this idea years ago of like video books, books. Remember when that was like the thing where people were embedding video into and other multimedia content into a book? And Seth basically said, look, this isn't going to work. It's not going to have any sort of longevity. Because the point of a book is to immerse yourself into a single idea and then to walk away with that idea. And he called a book a shareable idea. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, and with text, it creates all kinds of imagination. And, I think using multimedia to supplement is great, but there's something powerful. There's something really powerful to this 500-year-old technology that really hasn't changed much. It's still words on a page. Maybe it's a digital page now, words on a screen, but it's still very low tech. It's just you type some words and you put it on a page and people read it and it changes their lives. It changes their businesses. It changes communities. It changes the world. And all it is a shareable idea. It's something that I read and then can apply or communicate or share with the people in my circle of influence, or it's something that I can literally buy, you know, pull off the shelf and then hand to a friend. I go, you got to read this book because this is going to change your life. And in order to create that life-changing product, I think you have to have those three things that you talked about. It has to be a physical object, something that has a pass-along effect. It has to be compelling. And there has to be a certain sense of marketing savvy to it, which I just think is, you know, you're not trying to pull one over on anybody. You're just trying to make it easier for them to say yes to this thing that's going to help them in so many ways.
Right. Absolutely. Now, and I think the difference between a book and a piece of multimedia content is a book allows the reader to formulate their own images in their brain as they're reading it, right? When it's a multimedia object, you're basically feeding the images to the reader. So a book is more participatory, really. It's asking the reader to create their own vision of what is going on in that book. And I think that kind of seals the ideas into their brains a lot better because they're creating them themselves.
Yeah, it's sort of a call and response, and the book is the call. And if you have done your job well, the audience will respond.
Absolutely. All right, that's a great note to end on. Thank you so much, Jeff, and we'll have lots to talk about in our next conversation. You've given me a lot to think about.
Thanks. Well, I can't wait to hear what you have to report on for us to, you know, take note of and how you're applying this. So I'm excited. You have some homework to do.
I do. Thanks so much for your help.
You're welcome.